Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. John Linkos, the managing director at a leading cybersecurity firm known as Fortalis Solutions. They're based out of Charlotte, North Carolina. John, thanks for your time, and let's go ahead and get started.
Great. Thanks, Robbie, and great to be here.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, we looked up your bio, and you sent us your bio as well, and you seem to have a very rich historical background in cybersecurity. Can you tell us some of the highlights of your career, please?
Sure, yeah. So, some of the things I consider to be highlights of my career, I very early on, right after I graduated with my undergrad, I was lucky to be picked up by NASA, and I was working at Goddard Space Flight Center, learning a lot about distributed technology systems and sort of my first steps into security. I was the winner of the Individual Contractor of the Year award there. I've also been very lucky in that I've been able to work for some fairly large and well-known firms in the financial services arena. I was did a number of large projects for the New York Stock Exchange, Vanguard Investments, worked with a large number of healthcare payers like Blue Cross Blue Shields, providers, and pharma. I've also founded two successful consulting firms, a company called Technology Workflow Solutions out of Philadelphia in the mid-90s, and then Interpoint Group, which was the company that I was at just prior to moving over to Fortalis Solutions. But honestly, most of all, I'd say I'm just kind of a geek who likes technology. You know, I've been working with tech since I was a little kid, so.
Well, congratulations on those awards and your successful consulting companies. Now, how did you venture into Fortalis? Is this a company that you kind of helped create from the get-go, or?
It's not. It's actually an interesting story. So Fortalis is founded was founded by our current president and CEO, Teresa Payton. So Teresa was actually the first woman ever to serve as the CIO for the executive office of the president, the White House. She served under President George W. Bush during his second term. And when she left the White House, and prior to that, she had she was a VP at Bank of America in IT and InfoSec. So has a very long and storied career in technology and security. And so when she left the White House, she actually founded Fortalis Solutions about 10 years ago. Interestingly, I met Teresa about 10 years when she was founding Fortalis, but at that time I was working for another company, and then a couple of years later I founded Interpoint Group. So I didn't really help to create it. You know, we actually ran our consulting firms in parallel with each other, but we did often subcontract to each other. So there were times when we had certain types of projects that required skills that our team didn't have at Interpoint Group, things like open source intelligence, certain types of red teaming on the pen test side. And so we would work with Fortalis. And similarly, we had certain areas of expertise that Fortalis at the time really didn't have, like identity and access management and incident response plan development, things like that. And so they would contract with us. So it was a really symbiotic type of relationship. And then last year, as Teresa is pretty well recognized in the industry, she's one of the top speakers, out there on the speaking circuit, and she kind of recognized the value in combining our two firms together. So we started talking late last year, and then we closed the transaction and we announced the acquisition during the RSA event in April of this year out in San Francisco. So it's been fantastic. I mean, the Fortalis team is just a great group of people, and it's a very positive merger, simply because our team provides some additional capabilities that Fortalis didn't have previously, and certainly the Fortalis team does a lot of things that we could never do at Interpoint Group. Now we have a much broader set of capabilities that are all reporting up to one management structure.
Yeah, sounds excellent. Now, the name of your company has some significance behind it. What's the meaning of it? in terms of cybersecurity.
Sure, sure. Well, of course, the one thing is, of course, the pronunciation, right? And I know you've pronounced it correctly, but of course, we've heard everything. The correct pronunciation is, of course, Fortalice. We've heard Fortalice. We've heard Fortalice. We've heard, a bunch of things. But basically, a fortalice is a fortified structure, like a fort or a castle. And so for us, that name sort of refers to taking a defensive posture against cyber threats and creating a circle of trust, right? Of course, these days, as we all know, cybersecurity isn't about just protecting the fort, right? You know, no organization is a fort with a moat around it. The scope of the network is extended beyond the traditional perimeter of the firewall. So, you know, you now have mobile endpoints, you have the cloud, you have federated data that's shared with business partners. And so for us, the concept of the fort, it extends globally for the client organization. It's not just, hey, we're trying to protect what's inside the firewall. We're trying to protect the entire sum of the organization, which includes all of these fingers of data and services that extend out beyond the traditional scope of the internal network and the fort.
Okay, sounds excellent. Now, does Fortalice have a presence in other countries as well, or are you just a domicile here in the U.S.?
Yeah, at the moment, we're entirely U.S.-based. However, we do have plans for international expansion coming up here pretty quickly in the next few months. We will be starting out in the EMEA, Europe, Middle East, and Africa region in the early part of Q1 of next year. Now we'll have more information on that when it's publicly disclosable. But I can tell you that is an important aspect of our growth.
Okay. Now, who's your typical customer base that you try to target? Is it the small and medium-sized businesses, the larger companies like the Fortune 500, or is it a combination of both of them, or really anybody who has a cybersecurity need?
Yeah, you know, really, it truly is anyone. So, you know, our clients run the gamut from, you know, what would be called small to medium-sized businesses, right? So for us, you know, for us, I would say a small company would be a company that's doing, you know, maybe as little as $5 million a year in business, right, up through, you know, Fortune 500, right? So common vertical industries for us are things like legal and financial services, healthcare, retail, manufacturing. And so as you can imagine, those types of verticals really run that size range from, you know, smaller, you know, single office law organizations to global, you know, law organizations, financial services from, you know, small hedge funds up to global banks and stock exchanges, clinics up through major healthcare payers, providers, sort of mom and pop brick and mortar retail through, you know, global online retailers, et cetera. So it really runs the gamut. I will also say we also serve as a contractor for numerous federal government agencies as well. So we work as a partner with a number of federal agencies. We've also just recently acquired our GSA schedule. So we are going to continue to expand our government work, not only beyond the federal space, but also to the state and government level as well. One other, you know, category of customer that we have are individuals. So we do have a pretty substantial number of high net worth individuals as clients. So professional athletes, wealthy businessmen and women, and professional actors and actresses. And we help those people with things like personal digital protection and open source intelligence services as well.
Oh, excellent. I would have never thought of that. Wow, that's excellent. Now, let's get into your service line here in products. It looks like that, you know, Fortalice has distinct areas in cyber risk assessments, third-party risk management, penetration testing, blue-red teams, simulations of incident response plans, cybersecurity policy review, insider threats, and cybersecurity risk and governance. Could you please expand on more of those services in more detail, please?
Sure, sure. Well, you know, certainly I think if you look at the body of services that we provide as a whole, it really points at our ability to do sort of two things. Number one, that we do sort of a full stack of cybersecurity services. So everything from creation and management of cybersecurity programs, including cyber risk and governance, all the way down to the really tactical things like, you know, penetration testing, red and blue teaming, you know, incident response, you know, insider threat hunting, you know, third party risk management. So all of these things collectively, excuse me, are you know, sort of, I think, indicative of the fact that we do a full stack. The other thing that they're indicative of is the fact that we are vendor neutral. One of the advantages that we believe we have, and in fact that many of our clients like about us, is the fact that we're not a VAR or an SI, right? So we're not reselling anybody's technology. We're not building our own technology to sell it. We are pure professional services. And that's valuable to us because it means that, you know, we're not taking any revenue from any vendors. We're not there to push specific products or solutions. Our objective in all of these services that we offer is to recommend and implement the most appropriate solution for our clients. So for us, it's, you know, maybe a particular type of endpoint technology is appropriate for customer A, but is going to be something completely different for customer B. So, you know, looking at that sort of stack of services, I would say the first one you mentioned, cyber risk assessments, are probably the most common service that we sort of start out with going into client engagement. So very often when we have a new client, a risk assessment is one of the first things that we'll mutually agree on is going to be the most beneficial because it's going to really tell us where the soft targets are inside of that client environment. It's going to tell us where their major issues are. And then from there, and this is, you know, it's particularly important for clients who maybe know what they don't know about their own environment. And then from there, we help them by building out a roadmap and recommendations of specific projects. Now, some of those projects we can assist with if they want us to. They can do them themselves. They can obviously bring in a third-party firm to do them. But the value is really on the risk reduction there. So those cyber risk assessments will typically point to other activities that need to be done that were in that list you mentioned, things like, you know, third-party risk management assessments or pen tests or in developing an incident response plan or actually doing a tabletop review of that, you know, doing those policy reviews, et cetera. I'd also say that in addition to that stack of services, we actually offer some other services as well that, you know, we don't necessarily have on the website per se, but we do the actual digital incident response as well. So if a client has an incident, very often we are the very first phone call that they make and they say, listen, we've had an incident of some kind, you know, whether it's a ransomware incident or an insider threat problem, and they contact us, and then we send a team in immediately, usually within hours, to start collecting all the evidence related to that, doing the analysis, doing the triage, stopping the bleeding, and then doing the root cause analysis, the attribution, if we can do that to determine who actually did it, if that's relevant, and then of course the remediation to make sure that it doesn't happen again. Another service that we also offer that sort of ties into that stack is open source intelligence, or OSINT. So that comes out of really a lot of our team's experience in federal agencies, in a lot of the three-letter agencies where OSINT is a really valuable practice. And that really involves using open source data, you know, public records, looking at data on the dark web, et cetera, to really support and enhance some of our other services, particularly things like pen tests and simulation of incidents and incident response, as well as looking for things like insider threat.
Okay. Now, what kind of models do you use for your risk assessment? Is there a certain one that you use, or you just kind of do it on an ad hoc basis, depending what the needs of the client are?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. You know, in many cases, for some of our more cybersecurity mature clients, they will already have a particular risk-related models in place, and we can certainly use those. In other cases, clients will come to us and say, hey, you know, what should we be using for a risk model? So, and I'm going to break that down into different types of models. So, from a pure qualitative, quantitative risk model perspective. Very frequently we use the what's called FAIR, the factored analysis of information risk model. The FAIR model we find is great because it's a quantitative model. It's relatively easy to work with, and it's not overly complex, right? But we certainly use other models like ALE as well. If we're looking at threat, at something like threat modeling, we're big fans of the STRIDE model, which is the Microsoft model, as well as VAST, which is a model that's used specifically when doing threat modeling around SDLC and software development processes. And then to tie everything together, we tend to focus on the NIST cybersecurity framework, which is really for managing cyber risk. So regardless of the model that we're using for identifying risk, regardless of the model that we're using for modeling threats, the CSF is really what we use to typically tie all of that together and implement the management of those cyber risks.
Okay. Now, what is the depth of your penetration testing? I mean, like, what do you focus on? Do you go for all the way from A to Z, and do you also have a purple team as well? I noticed on your website you just mentioned red and blue, but do you have the purple ones as well too?
Yeah, we absolutely do. So before I get into that, a lot of our, I'll just start out by saying a lot of our red teamers, as I mentioned earlier, come out of the federal government offensive security program. So we've got a lot of depth in that area in terms of tactics and techniques. And, we have access to a pretty substantial library of tools. Of course, the tools are only as good as the actual pen tester, right? So, the tools are great to have, but it's really our value is in our ability to wield those and get results out of them. So generally, we focus on true red teaming. So what we will typically do with a client is we'll define specific objectives. So what is it that you want our team to try and do? Do you want us to try to escalate privilege? Do you want us to try to demonstrate an ability to move laterally between, trusted and untrusted to trusted networks? Do you want us to capture privileged information such as customer records or payroll data, et cetera? And then we'll attempt to achieve those objectives while avoiding detection or blocking by any of the client's defensive security mechanisms, right? So that could be things like, IDS and other firewall, device-based techniques. It could be endpoint security tools. It could be live people at the client's SOC, or if they have a SOC, or if they use an MSSP. So, for us, we when we say red teaming, we're talking about true red teaming. Now, having said that, not every client needs a full-blown red team exercise. Very often clients are coming in to have us do things like validate the security controls around a web application that they've developed internally, right? Or their cloud environment as they're migrating assets from on-prem to the cloud. And so we'll focus on more downscale, pure pen testing and sometimes even just vulnerability assessments on those as well. But the majority of the time, we're focused on really true red teaming. Now, you mentioned purple teaming services. Absolutely, that is certainly something that we offer. So when we do that, what we're doing is we've got an offensive and a defensive team. The offensive team is, of course, offsite working, out their methods to try and achieve those objectives I talked about earlier. But our blue team is simultaneously working with the client's own internal security team to help them look for those indicators of compromise that would say, hey, look over this console at this particular tool. Do you see that abnormality? That abnormality indicates that, somebody on the red team might be trying to, do something that they shouldn't be doing. And here's how you actually determine that and block that activity. So it becomes a real sort of live cat and mouse game where our client has full visibility into both the defense of, and if they choose, the offensive sides of the equation as well. And we found that's absolutely invaluable for giving clients a good understanding of, how sort of real world attackers work and how a real world SOC can identify those indicators of compromise and those attempts at exploitation and block them and potentially even do attribution to try and figure out who the actual malicious attackers are.
In what ways have you actually simulated a real-world cyber attack, and what was the appropriate response plan for that?
Sure, sure. Well, of course, you know, that type of activity is a core part of our services, right? We help clients by creating threat models of their systems and applications. Then we validate the exploitability of those threats through red teaming and other activities. And then we can help them integrate an effective response to those attacks into their IR plans. And of course, we also help clients simulate responses through things like tabletop exercises and other methods. And needless to say, we also help the clients by then providing them with detailed and actionable things that they can do to reduce the risks that we discover during the threat modeling process, right? But of course, you know, as we all know, right, there's no such thing as 100% security. And so having an effective incident response plan is vital for when those bad things eventually happen. And so, you know, for us, you know, we've simulated dozens of different types of real-world cyber attacks, everything from ransomware to insider threats to natural disasters. You know, what happens if a hurricane wipes out our data center, right? What happens if if an earthquake takes out our communications, you know, our primary communications channel to the outside world? How do we mitigate against that, and how do we resolve that type of problem? So we absolutely help clients with simulating those and then integrating the results of those tests into the incident response plan to make sure that when they do happen in the real world, that the client has an actionable plan for resolving those problems and making sure that, you know, the impacts are minimal.
Sounds excellent. Now, do you actually make security policies for clients? Do you actually craft them out word by word for clients that request those?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we develop security policies that are really tied to specific security program drivers, right? So, for example, let's say you're a healthcare provider, like a hospital. You might have multiple regulatory requirements. Certainly, you have HIPAA requirements, which require data being handled in a certain way. You might also have PCI DSS because you accept credit cards for payment. You might also have SOX because you're a publicly owned organization, right, rather than privately held. So all of those, the written security policies themselves need to reflect all of those regulatory drivers, as well as all the other requirements of the business, business partner and supplier agreements that have information security components, sort of all the things that comprise how, you know, what a security policy needs to be. And that could cover everything from data usage to acceptable system usage to system acquisition policies, really, you know, the full gamut. And then downstream from the policies, we also help organizations to develop standards and procedures that are directly derived from those policies. So that the idea being that, okay, not only do we have the written policy, which is more of the high-level statement, but we have specific standards that at any given time implement, you know, that security policy in a certain way. So, for example, if you have a security policy around encryption, you may have a standard associated with encryption that says these are the ciphers that we can use. This is the, how digital certificates have to be signed. This is the encryption strength, et cetera. And then you would have procedures that are derived from that policy that say, okay, here's how you actually create a PKI certificate in our environment, right? So the idea is to ensure that those policy standards and procedures are all fully enmeshed with each other, that they're consistent with each other, and that they don't conflict each other with each other in any way. And then once we develop those, of course, we also help our clients to educate their employees on those security program components. It's one thing to write a policy. It's another thing to make sure that your people understand it. And so we help our clients by helping them educate their employees through security awareness, gamification techniques, things like that.
So you do help them once the policy has been implemented. You do help them with, like, security training for employees and all that, too.
We do, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, recently, I mentioned gamification earlier. We've been really focused on gamification as a technique for improving the success of security awareness. The idea that, you know, simply having sort of a CBT or a once every 6 month questionnaire that you put your employees through to, you know, have them do a multiple choice, it's not particularly effective. It doesn't give employees sort of a sense of ownership of information security, whereas gamification does. So helping clients to do things like create a security program where if an employee does something they're supposed to do, like say forward what they think is a spam email to the help desk, well, if it is a spam email, they get 2 points for that, right? If they do something like identify a flaw in an application that the company uses, you know, they get 10 points for that. If they challenge someone who's trying to tailgate them through a door, through a secure doorway, and they challenge that person, you know, they get 20 points for that. And then after they accumulate a certain number of points, they get certain things for it, right? Everything from being able to use a certain title in the signature of their email, like security guru or wizard, to things like when they reach certain points, getting discounts for retailers, gift certificates, discounts for meals in the cafeteria, things like that. It really, really gives employees some ownership in the security awareness process.
Sure. Now, how have you dealt with insider threats? I know that's a big thing coming up. I've written a few blog pieces on that, and that's a kind of a hard thing to detect. How have you dealt with that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, very frequently, excuse me, first off, we have helped, you know, dozens of organizations that have experienced unusual activity on their network applications, which is usually the first indicator of compromise and when they contact us. So rarely will a client call us and say, hey, we have an insider threat problem and we think it with this person. That almost never happens. Almost always what they say is, hey, we're seeing something unusual here, and it's either unusual behavior associated with a group of people, or it's, we're seeing unusual network traffic activity to, say, a foreign country, and we don't know, you know, where that's coming from, and it's unusual data. Can you come in and help us out? And so what we do is we then go in and do a threat hunting exercise, right? We're there to come on board and then narrow down to a specific malicious insider through our threat hunting capabilities. And very often we will be able to do exactly that. Now, I will say this, you know, we consider ourselves to be professional secret keepers. And as a result, I can't mention any specific examples. But I can mention one that was publicly disclosed a few years ago, where there was a Chinese national who was working as a contractor for a company and on the East Coast. And that company was in the energy industry, renewable energy industry. And this Chinese national attempted to go to China with the client's IP. And we were able to provide definitive proof that he was planning on selling that IP. And working with local and federal law enforcement, our actions resulted in that perpetrator actually serving a pretty substantial prison sentence. So, wow. You know, our objective is always not only to help the client in terms of, punitively, finding the insider and prosecuting the fullest extent of the law, but also making sure that, that the damage that we're catching that person before too much damage is done, right? The last thing we want is, you know, after that IP has egressed to a foreign country or to another actor or competitor, whomever it happens to be, being able to resolve it at that point, that's no good. It helps for us to be able to get in as quickly as possible. So generally, the sooner the clients can come to us and say, hey, we think we see something unusual here, the faster that we can get in there and help to validate that. Or, as is sometimes the case, say, no, you know, we can understand why you thought that this was a potentially an insider threat, but it actually isn't. It's actually, you know, a misconfigured device, or, you know, there's a feedback loop on a device or something like that that's causing a problem.
Okay. Now, I know you talked about this a little bit before, but what exactly is a tabletop exercise and training? Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. So a tabletop exercise, or we just call it a TTX for shorthand, is basically when an organization simulates a security incident. And the incident itself can vary, right? But typically it's something that the organization has a reasonable expectation of actually seeing in the real world. Things like ransomware outbreaks, a data breach, an insider threat. And so, you know, the objective of the tabletop exercise is to ensure that if and when the incident occurs, the organization can effectively orchestrate all the aspects of incident response. That includes, you know, how do we triage, right? How do we stop the immediate bleeding? How do we do the root cause discovery to find out how this happened? How do we communicate this with all appropriate people, and how do we remediate it? And so, you know, for us, those TTXs aren't just technical people like IT and information security. They should include everyone who's involved with the incident. So that should include the victim. It should include human resources or public communications teams who handle public-facing crisis communications. It should include executive management, who's usually responsible for reporting those types of incidents to the board of directors or the shareholders. It should include third-party partners who might have been affected and other entities as well.
Sure. Can you tell us more about your reputation and threat monitoring services?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So, you know, Fortalice uses a combination of commercial tools coupled with some of our own open source intelligence capabilities to bring together reputation and threat data for our clients. So typically, we inform our clients immediately when we detect a significant threat to their industry. So on average, for example, we send in about 2 to 3 industry-specific alerts per month alerting our clients on credible threats. And those credible threats might come from federal government agencies like FBI notifications. We're in pretty tight with InfraGuard and some of the other federal agencies. They might come from DHS, or they might be our own that we see out there, or they might be data that we've aggregated from multiple sources that, hey, it looks like, you know, we're seeing an increase in attacks. A great example, as we come into the holiday season, I can guarantee you we're going to start seeing a ramp in attacks on retail organizations for a couple reasons. Number one, this is the time of year when they're doing the most transactions, and so very few eyes are on security at retailers, and more money is changing hands. So a single fraudulent transaction or a small number of fraudulent transactions is going to be harder to discern in a sea of stuff that's being sold. And so, I can tell you that probably within 2 to 3 weeks from now, we're going to see enough indicators of compromise that we'll be sending out an alert to the retail industry specifically around that. Now, that's for corporations and organizations. In addition to that, I mentioned earlier that we do reputation and threat data for individuals as well, like high net worth individuals. So, you know, for those folks, we're scouring the dark web. We are reviewing unusual social media account activity, like if they have an unusual number of mentions, or they're getting mentions in unusual groups or unusual forums. And, you know, we're basically trying to function as the canary in the coal mine for threats, so that we can help them to detect and respond before that threat turns into a significant incident.
Right? Sure. Now, what kinds of industries does Fortalice service?
Sure. So, you know, the vertical industries really run the gamut. As I mentioned, we do a fair amount of federal business, so we're working with a number of civilian and intelligence and DOD federal agencies. In the commercial world, I'd say probably our biggest verticals are financial services, and that would include, you know, banks, hedge funds, mutual funds, brokerages, investment banks, PE and VC firms, et cetera. Healthcare, and that includes payers, providers, pharmaceutical companies, medical device manufacturers, manufacturing companies. We have worked with a lot of manufacturers, particularly on things like OT network devices, IoT devices that are used in the manufacturing space, retail, and probably legal. But we also have clients in other areas as well: education, transportation and logistics, aerospace.
Okay. Do you have any customer success stories or any case studies you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, you know, I wish I could, but as those professional secret keepers, right, our clients don't want us to name them or some of the issues
sure,
we've helped
sure.
them with, and our ability to keep that as anonymous is one big reason they select us. But I can give you a few anecdotes about some of the recent projects we've done. Recently, we helped a major retailer to discover the root cause of gift card fraud. This organization was losing thousands of dollars a week in gift cards that were being fraudulently used, and so we were able to come down and discover the root cause of that and give them some recommendations for issuing those gift cards that would improve the process around them so that particular type of fraud couldn't occur in the future. That client has implemented those now and has literally seen that particular type of fraud completely drop off the radar, which is great. Recently, we helped a professional athlete whose social media accounts and phones have been compromised. We helped that athlete by kind of quickly wresting control back from the attacker, and we provided attribution of the actual attacker information. And that attacker was then arrested, which was obviously an outcome that we always like to see. And then for another large healthcare provider, we just finished up an engagement to help them improve their incident response capabilities, and we conducted a pretty comprehensive multi-day tabletop exercise of different types of incidents. So, those are just three examples, but I think they speak to the types of clients and projects that we're doing on an ongoing basis all the time.
Sure. Now, obviously, there are many cybersecurity vendors out there, in this country. But what separates Fortiless Solutions from the others? What I'm trying to get is, why should a customer come to you? What's that one thing that a customer should come to right off the first bet?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'd say this. I think a lot of cybersecurity companies are very much focused on what I would call the checkbox approach to security, right? You need a firewall? Check. You need endpoint security? Check. You need an annual pen test? Check. And they'll do those things for you. We're not focused on that. We're focused on really the efficacy of security, right? We're focused on making sure that the security policies, standards, processes, technical controls, and people within your organization are actually working to reduce risk. And we're doing that through measurement of risk. We're doing that through continuous validation of all of those things, those policy standards, processes, controls, and people. And our focus is really to ensure that regardless of what your checkbox needs are, what your compliance needs are, that you're really getting an efficient, customized security program that is specifically addressing your needs. One other differentiator for us is we approach security with what we call white glove service, right? So rarely are our projects canned. Client, yes, we may do a pen test for client A and we may do a pen test for client B, and the scope may be different, but we're always focused on creating bespoke and client-specific services. So even though there's two pen tests, the objectives of those pen tests may be very, very different. A red team exercise, for example, for client A may be focused on protecting their intellectual property. For client B, it may be based around protecting their PHI data or other types of information in their environment. For another client, it may be protecting their SCADA devices or their OT network devices, right, from attack. So really making sure that whatever services we are doing for our clients really are adding value and really ultimately helping to reduce risk.
Okay. Now, do you offer any free trials or any free risk assessments to a customer before they come on board or even when they are on board?
Yeah, it's interesting you ask that question. One of the most common projects that we do for new clients, as I mentioned earlier, is a cyber risk assessment, right? So typically that's a fairly detailed and complex effort, right? Can take a couple of weeks to complete. But recently we've developed a much lower cost quick strike of a risk assessment called a Cyber 360 Posture Review. And that's really designed as an inexpensive quick strike approach to understanding what a client's soft targets are from a cyber risk perspective, and then helping to build out a plan to address those issues based on, targeting the low-hanging fruit first, right? So it basically says, allows the client to take a really low-risk approach. First off, get a lot of valuable information. Second, pay relatively little money for it, and then third, get them experienced into the Fortalis way, right, in terms of how we work with clients. And you know, if the client after that, after we've done that 360 posture review, once they have their deliverables and all that detailed information, if they choose to move forward with us, that's great. That'll sort of get their foot in the water. If they choose not to or choose to do those things on their own, they can do that as well. But either way, it's a really low-risk way for them to get acclimated to the Fortalis way of doing things.
Okay, excellent. Now, do you have like a partner program or a value-added reseller program to kind of expand your network out there?
We do, yeah. We have two types of partners. We have referral partners. Most commonly, those are like law firms and insurance firms that we work with who refer us to their clients who have specific cybersecurity needs. But we also have reseller partners who own the client transaction, and effectively we become a subcontractor for them. So, you know, they may be a reseller who's implementing, upgrading their client's Palo Alto firewalls. They're going to do the actual, you know, stacking and programming of the firewalls, but where they're going to bring us in is to do the firewall rule set review to say, okay, you know, you have all of these firewall rules that were migrated from your old system to the new system. Do they all make sense, right? You know, are all of these policies still valid? You know, here are some that are sort of maybe against, you know, industry best practices, like, you know, any rules, things like that. So, yeah, we absolutely work with, you know, with both types of those partners.
Okay. Now, let's just segue over now to the cybersecurity landscape in general. Now, we keep hearing about nation-state threat actors like North Korea, China, Russia. Now, with the midterms coming up, there's fear about Russia meddling again. Like, what are just your general thoughts on that? I mean, I don't mean to get political here, but, I mean, we keep hearing about day after day after day. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I absolutely think there is no doubt that nation states continue to be the most advanced threat actors in the entire cybersecurity realm, right? And they're the most advanced not only from a technology perspective, because they have the resources of an entire country that can, you know, or groups of countries in some cases that they can throw against the problem and a lot of brain power, but also because they're the ones that are typically going after new areas of cyber threats, such as, you know, technology supply chain integrity, kinetic threats, right? You know, it used to be a time when the only thing we were worried about was, you know, monetary gain, right? That's the big problem. And now it's not about monetization anymore or just monetization. These are actors that are posing actual physical threats to human targets.
Okay. Now, what are your general plans for expansion for Fortalis? Are you planning to offer new products, services, or enter newer markets, or maybe a combination of both?
Yeah, certainly. Well, in addition to the international, expanding out to the international market that I mentioned earlier, you know, we're always looking for at and constantly evaluating the market, and more specifically, what we can do to help organizations reduce risk and become more safe. And so, over the past year, we've added or expanded new services, for example, some of our OSINT offerings, identity and access management practice, to accommodate those aspects of cybersecurity that are, you know, that we see as being more frequently attacked or more frequently at risk, right? So, you know, one of the things we've seen clients interested in more and more in the past couple of months, for example, and say probably the past 6 to 9 months, is privileged identity management. And the reason for that is because there have been a number of successful data breaches of organizations whose privileged accounts were compromised. And so organizations recognize the need and importance of getting control over those. And so, sure, there are specific technologies that you can use to do that, but there are a dozen different ways that you can implement privileged identity management. And so we work with our clients to first off come up with an understanding of, you know, where the risks are around privileged identity in their organizations. Is it that, you know, you've got multiple users using the same admin account? Is it that you have, you know, a lot of service accounts out there that haven't had their passwords changed in, you know, in 10 years? You know, what are the problems with those accounts? And then, you know, how do you come up with a strategy to mitigate the problem. And then later on at the end, let's talk about specific tools and technologies, right? And we can recommend those. That's one example of how we sort of expand out to new services based on, some of the risks and other factors that we see in the market today.
I'm just wondering, has Fortalist done any work with the Internet of Things? I know that's like the new and upcoming thing here in technology.
Yeah.
Engaged in.
Yeah, we do, absolutely. So we actually have a group within our red team that specializes in IoT. And so what they're actually doing is, for example, we have a company, a client right now, that is a medical device manufacturer, and they have us evaluating their technologies, which are network connected, to determine how safe they are, right? And obviously, when it comes to healthcare delivery, the risks for healthcare delivery are much greater than they are for probably anything else, because people can literally. Lives are literally on the line, right? We absolutely do that. We also focus on other areas of IoT as well, in particular IoT protocols. So as part of our R&D internally with our red teams, in conjunction with our blue team folks, are constantly looking at new IoT protocols and services that are out there, and helping to evaluate those to determine how safe and secure they are, or how safe and secure they are not.
Right. Yeah, I just actually wrote a blog post thing, I think several days ago, on how the pacemaker of all things can be a cybersecurity threat risk. I mean, a cyber attacker can, mess with your own pacemaker. You just don't know when that could, something could happen. It's really scary.
Now, absolutely. Yeah, most definitely.
Now, we keep hearing about the C-suite, the C-level executive being held more accountable for their organizations, and we keep hearing how, they're just not responsive and they don't know enough and so forth. How do you see all that shaking out here in 2019?
Yeah, I think we have a fundamental problem in the cybersecurity world when it comes to dealing with the C-suite and particularly the board of directors and shareholders. And that is that we are generally very, very poor at translating cybersecurity risk into business risk. In other words, a lot of organizations can internally tell you that, hey, here are our biggest areas of risk in terms of, endpoint security and in terms of perimeter security and device security and IoT security. What they're not really good at doing is translating that into what is the impact to the business. And maybe that impact is direct. Maybe it's okay if these systems are compromised, these particular systems, then, we no longer have an ability to deliver a revenue generating service, and that impacts the company to the tune of, X millions of dollars a day. Maybe it's a case where if another system is compromised or another threat is realized, we lose the ability to do work with a particular third party supplier, and that supplier is critical to our business, right? They're the sole supplier for some critical component of widget that we manufacture as a company. I think the biggest problem from my perspective is this failure to be able to effectively communicate what the business value of cyber risk is, explaining it in a way that is non-technical. And a lot of people will tend to think, okay, well, if I'm sending something up the board level or the C-suite, well, I have to dumb it down. Well, no, you don't have to dumb it down. You have to change the context. Our context tends to be more technical. The context of the board tends to be, much more related to fiscal fiduciary responsibility that they have, and also to the continuity of the business and business functions. So I think, I think the real value for cyber moving forward into 2019 and beyond, for kind of closing that gap and getting the C-suite more involved in cyber, is for the people in the cyber component of the business to be able to communicate effectively in the language of the business. And if we can start doing that consistently, if we can start presenting our security metrics in a way that really help the C-suite to understand what the real impact of the business is, our relationship with C-suite is going to become dramatically better. We're going to get the kind of budgets that we need in order to really minimize the most critical risks in our environment. And we're going to make a lot more friends in the C-suite and the BOD.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, how do you foresee the cyber threat landscape changing in the coming years? I mean, it's changing almost every day, but what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. Well, you know, I think from a threat perspective, we already talked about nation states, right? I think nation state actors are going to continue to be the most pervasive threat. But, you know, I think from a defensive perspective, I'm actually seeing some hope. And the hope that I'm seeing is a lot of what's being done on the algorithmic front to move threat detection further to the left. And so what I mean by that are, as you look at some of the new endpoint solutions that are out there, some of them are really innovative, right? I see vendors starting to use AI and machine learning, not just as empty marketing slogans that don't mean anything, but actual capabilities that can help organizations to detect, you know, the subtle abnormalities and policy violations that can be early indicators of compromise. So, you know, while I see the threats growing and increasing in terms of pervasiveness and capability, I am actually starting to see some real movement on the defensive front. I think, you know, we were in a fairly stagnant career in cybersecurity for a while where everybody's approach was, let's just build a bigger, better, faster firewall. And that approach just isn't going to work anymore. And so I think, you know, as you look at the industry now, you look at, for example, just as one simple metric, the number of cybersecurity vendors that are at RSA from year to year, it's just growing and growing and growing. It's going to be close to 1,000 vendors this year. And all of these vendors, you know, in large part have really useful technologies. And I think that's a positive sign. Many of them are really, really innovative. They may be small companies, but many of them are doing really, really amazing things to actually move that threat detection further to the left in the cybersecurity equation.
Okay. Now, we keep hearing about cyber threats, some of the newest ones like ransomware, you know, crypto mining, crypto tracking, you know, BEC and what have you. Based on your experience, what do you think the biggest cyber threat will be like in 2019?
Sure. So, you know, my biggest concern is the migration of attacks that we're seeing today, which are really based around disinformation, monetization, and sensitive data egress, to kinetic attacks. Kinetic attacks worry me. So, you know, 10 years ago, DHS, Project Aurora, right, proved that kinetic attacks were actually possible. They remotely hacked a programmable logic controller and a generator, and they caused a complete failure. There's a video available for it online. It's pretty astounding. You know, move forward a couple of years, we had Stuxnet, which was, you know, malware that implemented that concept on a wide scale. The problem, I think, is now exacerbated by all the IoT that we have today. You mentioned IoT earlier, right? You know, manufacturers are insisting that we connect our refrigerators or garage door openers or home automation equipment to the internet, and in many cases using, you know, new and highly insecure protocols. And I think we're really just going to be entering the Wild West era of kinetic threat exploitations. So, you know, for me, my big fears are those things that can be hacked that can cause physical harm to people, medical devices, cars, water systems, public infrastructure, things like that. Those are
right.
Those are the things I think are that keep me up at night more than, you know, is my bank account going to get hacked?
So you're talking more like critical infrastructure threats will be the big ones, though.
Yeah, critical infrastructure threats, but even not necessarily critical infrastructure. Again, things like, you know, if someone hacks your a medical device, right? Like a pacemaker or an individual's car, the potential damage from that can be extreme.
Sure. Now, finally, as you wrap up the show, what do you recommend to people to protect themselves from a cyber attack or cyber risk? You know, I mean, everybody asks the same question, but from your experience, what are the, like, one or two things you can tell the audience? Hey, how do you protect yourself from being hacked into?
Sure. Well, you know, there's certainly no as you know, right, no single thing that an organization or an individual can do. The good news is it's generally easier for an individual to protect themselves than, you know, say, a Fortune 500 company. So a couple things I recommend. You know, obviously, the basics, right? Always use security software on your devices, antivirus or something more effective, including your mobile devices. Always keep your computers and your mobile devices up to date for security patches. I know it's a pain watching, you know, that, you know, hey, Windows is updating, but it's really, really important. And that should also include your third-party software, things like Adobe Acrobat. If you're connecting from public locations, like a public Wi-Fi or a hotel, always use an encrypting VPN, right? They're very inexpensive, $5 to $8 a month. They give you anonymous, fully encrypted access to the internet, regardless of the level of security on the local network, which is great. When it's available, always use two-factor authentication. So, you know, for your banks, that's generally and financial accounts, that's generally pretty common today. And it may seem like a pain, but it'll protect you from the majority of ways in which your accounts can be compromised. So I recommend doing that for Twitter, your social media accounts as well. If it's offered as an option, always choose an app-based multi-factor authentication like Google Authenticator, which is more safe than sending SMS messages to your phone. And then just one or two more things, you know, don't overshare information, right? It's great that you're taking a two-week vacation to Australia, but the fact that you're advertising that on Facebook means a lot of people, and depending on your settings, possibly the entire general public is going to know about that, and everybody, you know, comes out, you know, potentially bad people could come after you, right? And then, you know, finally, if it sounds too good to be true, it is. 15 years ago, the most popular scam threats were, you know, the Nigerian prince and the 419 type threats. It's robocall scams and unsolicited texts from people pretending to know you or wanting to romance you, buying and selling scams, things like that. Being skeptical should really be the default approach for everybody when dealing with the internet.
Great. Just one last thing. You think password managers are effective?
Absolutely. Yeah, I use one myself. You know, I think never using the same password for multiple online services is really, really important. Use complex passwords, or even better, the great thing about password managers, you know, like Dashlane, LastPass, et cetera, they'll generate maximum complexity passwords for you, and it's really easy to change them on a regular basis. I mean, I take literally 15 minutes once a month and go into my password manager and, you know, just let it automatically generate new passwords for all my online services. It ties into the APIs for those services, changes them automatically. So, you know, my bank accounts, my, you know, my investment account, you know, all the other, you know, my Twitter account, everything is just automatically changed, and it makes life a whole lot easier.
Well, John, we thank you for your time, taking some time out this weekend. We hope to speak with you again in the near future. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Robbie. Take care.
Take care.